I now can sing since I've been redeemed.
I'm on the everlasting rock.
I faith in Christ, my Redeemer King.
I'm on the everlasting rock.
This is the voice of hope.
Then roll, roll, billows roll. I'm on the everlasting rock of ages. Roll, roll, billows roll. I'm on the everlasting rock.
Crown him with many crowns, the Lamb upon his throne. Hark how the heavenly anthem drowns all music but its own. Awake, my soul, and sing of him who died for thee, and hail him as thy matchless king through all eternity.
Crown him the Lord of love, behold his hands and side, rich wounds yet visible above, in beauty glorified. No angel in the sky can fully bear that sight, but downward bends his burning eye at mystery so bright.
Crown him the Lord of years, the potentate of time, creator of the rolling spheres, ineffably sublime. All hail, Redeemer, hail, for thou hast died for me. Thy praise shall never fail throughout eternity.
Thank you, men, for that wonderful song of praise. And thank you, my friend, for tuning in to the Voice of Hope. I'm J. Mark Horst, your friend and Bible teacher. Last week on the Voice of Hope, we were studying from Daniel chapter 11. Our study was titled, Of Men and Nations. Daniel chapter 11 is unique. There's no other chapter in the Scriptures that's quite like it. After last week's program, I got an email from a listener. He kindly pointed out a mistake I made in one of the details of my teaching. In verses 7 to 9, I was referencing how much silver Ptolemy III had carried away from the northern king. And I said it was about $1.25 million worth. But actually, in today's value, it was about $1.25 billion with a B dollars worth. And that's quite a difference. You know, here on the Voice of Hope, we appreciate each and every one of you who listen. We're thankful for our interactions with you too, whether it's by email or by phone or face to face. Our lives have been enriched by your friendship and by your partnership. And for that, we praise the Lord.
The church is one foundation, is Jesus Christ her Lord. She is his new creation by water and the word. From him he came and sought her to be.
Now, let's return to our study in Daniel chapter 11, and to begin, I will read verses 21 to 35. And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him, and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches. And he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For the ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Notice with me, the vision refers to Antiochus as a vile person, someone who is revolting and morally despicable, a reprobate. We also learn from the text that Antiochus wasn't the natural successor to the throne. That is, he wasn't given the throne by the people or by the royal family. Instead, he seized it through intrigue. He pretended to be the guardian of the rightful heir, but historically he's suspected of arranging for the heir's murder. By deceit and treachery, he eliminated the rightful heirs of the throne and their officials. His obtaining the throne peaceably simply means he didn't have to fight a war to get it. Once he secured his position, he began a series of conquests against the two major powers opposing him, Egypt and Rome. And against Egypt, he won many victories. Verse 22 mentions some of these successes against his enemies. And it also mentions that the prince of the covenant, like his other enemies, would be swept away like a flood. This prince of the covenant is believed to be the Jewish high priest Onias III. History tells us that Onias had Egyptian sympathies, and that didn't sit too well with the ruling religious class in Jerusalem. They were making too much money as Antiochus' puppets, and they didn't want their plan interrupted or ended. So Onias' murder was ordered by Antiochus in 172 BC. Verse 23 describes Antiochus' various treaties with other nations, and especially with Egypt. True to his character, these agreements involved both deception and intrigue. His only goal in his alliances was to increase his power, and he was quite successful at it. Now, as I mentioned before, Antiochus was always looking to expand his power and his wealth. So he plundered the richest parts of the surrounding country. He especially attacked places that were at peace, people who were not expecting to be attacked. But there was one particular way that he was much different from his predecessors. Most kings kept captured wealth for themselves, but Antiochus took the captured wealth and he spread it around. He used it to buy favor and allegiance from those who would possibly be his rivals. He was both cunning and ruthless. His expeditions aren't named in the text, but they were against Egypt, and he swept his enemies before him like a flood. Egypt's allies, that is, the ones who ate of the king's delicacies, deserted him in his time of need, and their disloyalty allowed Antiochus to be victorious. Verses 27 and 28 mention the various agreements that were made between Syria and Egypt. The common characteristics of these agreements is that they did not stand. The reason for that is because both kings were deceitful in making them. They are said to speak lies at the same table. That sounds like politics today, doesn't it? For obvious reasons, these treaties weren't successful. They didn't last. In all of this, God's timetable is moving forward right on schedule. I want you to notice the last part of verse 27. For the end will still be at the appointed time. God was using this vile man, Antiochus Epiphanes, to fulfill his divine will and his purpose. Then, evidently, in one of his expeditions to Egypt, Antiochus returns in triumph with great riches. The text mentions that at this specific time, he begins to manifest his intense hatred for the Jewish people and his covetous lust for the treasures that were housed in their temple. His atrocities against the Jewish people as he returns from Egypt are well documented in Maccabees 1 and 2. So far, in the text, Antiochus has known very few military and political defeats, but that's about to change. In one of his many forays into Egypt, he manages to capture the current Ptolemy, remember that's the title of Egypt's kings, but he fails to capture the city of Alexandria. And because of that, he's forced to withdraw his army. In a subsequent invasion, he's confronted by the forces of Rome at Alexandria, and the Roman general gives him an ultimatum: leave Egypt immediately or be attacked by Rome. And that made Antiochus really angry. But he had enough sense to do as he was told, and he conceded Egypt to Roman authority. Like most men with anger issues, that wasn't the end of the story, because Antiochus' anger was going to be vented on someone with less power. And notice who the recipients of that anger were. He shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. God's people Israel were about to experience Antiochus' full wrath. Evidently, according to verse 30, some of the Jewish people, fearing that wrath, will forsake the covenant in order to curry favor and protection from his administration. And he does favor them. Here's what Josephus had to say about this time. A Jew named Jason wanted to be the high priest. Knowing Antiochus' reputation, Jason offered the king a bribe to depose the current high priest, who was Onias III. Remember, you heard his name earlier. And Antiochus cooperated. This state of affairs encouraged another pretender to the high priesthood, and his name was Menelaus. He used the same tactic against Jason. And Antiochus cooperated again. Onias, whom the Jews respected, raised an objection, and it cost him his life for doing that. Antiochus executed certain individuals for their alleged roles in these maneuverings, but he didn't punish Jason or Menelaus. Instead, he scapegoated the people of Jerusalem, again in response to bribes. After Jason attempted a coup when he thought that Antiochus was dead, Antiochus entered Jerusalem, killed 80,000 men, and accompanied by Menelaus, desecrated the temple. That happened in 168 BC. Verse 31 outlines Antiochus' desecration of the temple and the altar. History tells us that Antiochus ordered his general, Apollonius, and 22,000 soldiers into Jerusalem on what he claimed was a peaceful mission. But once they got inside the city, they attacked the Jews on the Sabbath day, when the Jews were reluctant to exert themselves. Apollonius killed many Jews, and he took many Jewish women and children captive as slaves. He also plundered the temple, and then he burned the city. Antiochus' objective was to exterminate Judaism and to Hellenize Palestine. That is, he wanted to force the adoption of Greek religion and culture on the Jewish people. To accomplish that, he prohibited the Jews from following the Mosaic law, and he did away with the Jewish sacrifices. He canceled their festivals, and he outlawed the rite of circumcision. He even burned copies of their law. As a culminating measure, he installed an image of Zeus, his Greek god, in the temple and erected an altar to Zeus on top of the altar of burnt offerings. Then he went further. He sacrificed a pig, an unclean animal, to the Jews on that altar and ordered the Jews to sacrifice swine's flesh on the altar. This happened on December 16th, 168 BC. The Jews referred to this act as the abomination that caused desolation. It polluted their altar, and it made sacrifices to Yahweh impossible. And then Antiochus went even further. He ordered his Jewish subjects to celebrate his birthday by offering a pig to Zeus on this altar. This is the abomination that makes desolate, referred to by Jesus. The parallel prophecy is in Daniel 8:23-25. Just a note here about the critics of Daniel. If Jesus quoted Daniel's prophecy in Matthew 24:15, isn't that in itself sufficient evidence for the reliability of Daniel's prophecy? I'll let you decide how you want to answer that question. These actions by Antiochus brought about the Maccabean Revolt, where thousands of Jewish people were slaughtered. While the events that are listed here in our text were fulfilled historically in the reign of Antiochus, they are also prophetic of the future time of Jacob's trouble, or the Great Tribulation. In Matthew 24:15, where Christ is describing the Great Tribulation, he links the desecration of the temple as being similar in kind to the events of the end. Remember, Antiochus' desecration happened long before Jesus came on the scene. So Antiochus becomes a type of the future man of sin. His actions foreshadow the ultimate blasphemy of the Antichrist. Now note with me here Antiochus' ongoing attempts to subvert the Jewish people. By flatteries, he corrupts those who were nominally committed to the covenant. But the committed ones are commended for their strength and for their valiant deeds. You know, this was a time of separating the chaff from the wheat. Antiochus' attempt to destroy the Jewish people actually led to a revival of genuine worship, as much as that was possible. Many were instructed by the righteous, and they were urged to commitment by the example of the martyrs. It was during this time that the Hasidim group began to grow. They advocated for a strict observance of the Mosaic law, and they became the forerunners of the Pharisees of Jesus' day. And later on, a smaller group of them became the isolationist Essene community that lived at Qumran beside the Dead Sea. The Essenes repudiated the rationalism of the Sadducees and the materialism of the Pharisees. And they were also responsible for preserving many manuscripts of God's Word in the caves at Qumran. It is sad to realize how corrupt the Jewish religious leadership became during this time. They were engaging in the very sins for which their forefathers went into captivity in Babylon. You know, I can only imagine the grief this must have been to Daniel as he received these prophecies. But this revival that was happening came with a high price. Notice the faithful fell by the sword, by the fire, by captivity, and by spoil for many days. Verse 35 says that this purging will continue until the time of the end. But the messenger specifically notes again that what is prophesied is yet for a time appointed. The end referenced is not the end of Antiochus, but the end of the age. Verse 36, then, jumps from the time of Antiochus to the final generation prior to God's judgment of Gentile power and authority. It begins unfolding prophecy that is yet to be fulfilled. We'll take up that study next time here on The Voice of Hope. As we close, think about it. The God who controls human history, the God who orchestrates world events to fulfill His plans and purposes, that same God has your life and mine ordered too. Now it's true, He doesn't force us to follow His plans, but our lives will have far more meaning and far more joy and far more purpose if we're willing to let Him take control. Have you given Him that privilege? I'm not asking if you went to an altar years ago and prayed the sinner's prayer. And I'm not asking if you raised your hand in a meeting and had a pastor pray for you. I'm not even asking if you've been baptized and have your name on the membership roll of a church. All of those things are good. But what I am asking you is this: have you given God control of your life? Is He the master and are you the servant? Or do you just need Him when there are things you can't do for yourself? You know, the scriptures know nothing of claiming Jesus for salvation while rejecting Him as Lord. So I urge you, make Him your Lord and Master today.
Rise, glorious conqueror, rise into thy name, disguise, assume thy rights, and where in manifold the clouds are backward rolled, pass through those gates of gold and reigning light. Victor or death and hell, cherubic legions swell the radiant train, praises on him, inspire each angel, sweeps his lyre, and claps his wings afar, the Lamb was slain. Enter in carnage, God, no feet but thine have trod the serpent down. Blow the full trumpets, blow wider yon portals throw, save your triumphant call and take thy crown. Lion of Judah, hail, and let thy name prevail from age to age. Lord of the rolling years, claim for thine own the spheres, bought with thy blood and tears, thy heritage.
My friend, were you blessed by the teaching on today's broadcast? If so, you can have an audio CD or a printed manuscript of this teaching, Of Men and Nations. Or you can log on to our website, heraldsofhope.org, and listen to this teaching when it's convenient for you. You can contact us by email at hope@heraldsofhope.org. Or you can call us toll-free at 866-960-0292 or mail your comments to The Voice of Hope, Box 3, Breezewood, Pennsylvania, 15533. Another option is to log on to our website, heraldsofhope.org, and use the Contact Us button that's right there on our homepage. And there's also a place there where you can share a prayer request with us. If you want to connect on Facebook, you can visit our page where you can see a daily prayer request, learn about upcoming events, or read an encouraging testimony. It's also an easy way for you to send a message to us. Now, once again, you may contact us by email at hope@heraldsofhope.org. By mail, The Voice of Hope, Box 3, Breezewood, Pennsylvania, 15533. Or pick up your phone and call us toll-free at 866-960-0292. Or visit our website, heraldsofhope.org, to learn more about the ministry and how you can become a partner with us. You can also listen to any of our archived programming when you visit the website. And remember, you can request a printed manuscript or an audio CD of this complete teaching of Men and Nations. Now, if you'd like to help support this ministry financially, you can include a gift with your letter or donate online at heraldsofhope.org, or by calling our toll-free number, 866-960-0292. We do depend upon God's grace and your fervent prayers, along with your generous financial support, to enable the Voice of Hope to be on the air until Jesus comes in the air. Now, friend, I'll look for you next week here on The Voice of Hope. And until we meet again,
someday a bright